Welcome to the Independent Curriculum Group's Partner Podcast. The Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast highlights the work of our partner schools and organizations in the development of contemporary education as they embrace and enact the ICG's principles of independent curriculum. The Independent Curriculum Group is a consortium of over 150 schools around the world committed to creating learning experiences based on their own missions and their own values, and designed for their own students. Because independent curriculum is created in individual schools by teachers to serve their very own students, we say that independent curriculum is innovative by definition. You can learn more about us and read our principles by visiting our website at independentcurriculum.org. Today, I'm very excited to be talking with Mike Simpson, a co-founder and the head of school at the Stone Independent School in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Mike, thank you for joining us for the Partner Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Peter. I am really excited to have this conversation and to continue to work with you closely.
Well, as am I. Our usual order of business here is to ask for some fast facts about your school, but I'm going to jump ahead and ask you about yourself before we talk about the school. How did you come to be a head of school? And can you tell us about your path, maybe up to the moment of Stone's founding?
Yeah, it's pretty non-traditional, I think. I remember I was hired out of grad school by a great independent school here in Lancaster. And it's funny, I remember we had a great head of school. His name was Mike Mirsky. He's now working at St. Edward's in Vero Beach, Florida. And I remember talking to him in the parking lot one day. This is in maybe October or November of my first year ever teaching. And I just kind of had this moment where I thought, you know, what a cool job. What an amazing job this guy gets to have, you know, how little I knew. And that was really the beginning of my arc towards becoming head of this school. But in truth, I often tell people I don't really have the qualifications. I didn't look particularly closely at education as a career in college. My first year or two out of college, I worked in finance. And I kind of had one of those moments that I think a lot of people have in education where I saw this opportunity to take a job at an environmental education company up in New England. I wasn't in love with finance. I didn't feel particularly satisfied by anything I was doing at any point in time in my day. I mean, even then I kind of knew I wanted to read a lot and to write a lot, and I wasn't doing any of those things. And so on a whim, I took this job. And really disappointed my parents. and began working for this company called Nature's Classroom up in Vermont, or up in New Hampshire. And it was amazing. It was the first time I'd worked with kids. And I think that experience ended up framing out what I love about teaching, which was the work was very close. We worked long, very difficult hours. Everything was project-based, either intentionally or not intentionally. And the teachers who work there and the teachers that I see coming out of environmental education have a kind of dynamic and very diverse range of skills. And I think you hone those by working with a lot of different kinds of kids and working in, you know, 90 degree weather and in snowstorms and, you know, doing some, you know, great lab work and also cleaning toilets. And that was really, I think, where I fell in love with how all consuming education can be. And from there on, it was, you know, go to grad school for 3 years, and then begin to work my way up through, the independent school world. I began as an English teacher. You know how independent schools work. They'll let you do anything that you're willing to do, right? By the end of my first year, I was coaching two sports. 4 or 5 years in, I became director of student activities, and that got me doing some dean work. And ultimately I was doing, I designed the service program and the global education program, and I was kind of junior admin and involved in most aspects of the school. But in truth, I did not, and I never have had, the traditional head of school training or pathway or even credentials. And that's kind of been an important part, I think, of our story and of my story also.
Mm-hmm. So there you were, and then suddenly, as I understand it, or maybe not so suddenly, you and a few colleagues had an idea that became the Stone Independent School. Mm-hmm. How did that come to pass, and what was the idea?
You know, I think the evolution of our school, we worked on this project for 3 years, kind of formally. I think there were 2 or 3 years before that where there was kind of it was a lot of conversations that all felt very similar. And to be very honest, they were all about the look and feel of what we would have called 21st century education 6 or 7 years ago. You know, I think that as my career moved in the direction that it did, I began to feel the tension between what I think can be a really amazing school culture and also a very dynamic form of education, but also the demands of the AP system and the pressures of college counseling. And so I think for 2 or 3 years, we were just like a lot of people. You know, you'd go out for a cup of coffee or you'd go out for a beer with your colleagues and you'd say, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we started our own school? And in fact, there were a lot of people in our community that I would talk to who would kind of say the same thing. They'd say, you know, I was going to start a school, or, you know, I had a couple meetings with some people. A lot of people have thought about it, right? And so for us, it really came down to figuring out what our why was. Why did we want to do this? And our core why has always been that I have, and I think all of us have, a lot of skepticism towards the notion of testing. We talk about, you know, testing in public schools. We talk about testing in independent schools. But even tests, you know, the kind of natural endpoint of a unit in most classes is some kind of test. And I just never saw particularly great ones or even interesting ones. And so we kind of really began with this idea of, what if we just get rid of the idea of testing writ large and writ small? What happens then? And that was kind of the core idea. That was always the core idea, is this doesn't feel like it accumulates towards anything. So let's move in a different direction.
Well, so yeah, I think a lot of us who work in this field, maybe all of us, have had this wild idea at some point. Mercifully, in my case, when I was too young to actually figure out how to do anything about it, that, you know, if we had our own school, we could just do things right. But then yeah. You guys actually set out to do that. And I wonder if you could walk us through some of the early steps as the idea came into sharper focus and the vision of an actual school began to really take form.
You know, there is a moment where we kind of said, all right, we're going to go for it. But in truth, it takes 100 conversations to have the first meaningful conversation. And that first meaningful conversation, it turns out, isn't the meaningful conversation. It turns out there's another 30 that have to happen. And so when people ask me, how do you start a school? You know, I often say, you start it really slowly and then really quickly. It began again with us feeling like there was a way to build a program that was more dynamic and a way to build a program that had more relevancy to our students' natural lives, but also to their futures. I sat through so many final exams, you know, and watching students prepare for them in a way that only prepared them to take the final exam. Watching our students a minute after those final exams dump all of their books and their notebooks in the trash and then kind of run up and down the hallway screaming, like we are finally away from this monster. And I taught juniors and seniors, and I would, you know, we'd come back to school in the fall and I'd reference something on my final exam and none of my kids could even remember it. And so when I say look and feel, I mean, you know, I think it begins with being very introspective as a teacher and wondering, doing something that's meaningful and purposeful here with these kids, right? And the flip side is all of my students always wanted to feel like their work had value and purpose. So trying to answer your question in a roundabout way, there wasn't one moment until there was one moment. And that one moment was this. The assistant head of school here is Abby Kirchner, and she and I were lucky to chaperone a trip to Nepal. We had been working with the refugee community in Lancaster. There's actually a very, very large refugee community in Lancaster. I think per capita, we have the largest refugee community in the United States. And so we'd been working with there's a large Nepalese Bhutanese population in Lancaster. And I was lucky to take a cohort of students to Nepal in, I think, 2014. And then Abby and I took four students to Nepal in 2015. And that trip was a complete disaster. Everything that could have gone wrong did. There was an incident at Kathmandu Airport before we got there, which kept us stuck in Dubai for like 3.5 or 4 days. We couldn't leave the hotel.
Whoa.
And then we got to Kathmandu and literally all of our bags were lost for another 2 or 3 days. The trek to the school that we were working with was very high elevation and our kids were very sick for most of it. It was hard, hard work. And about 9 days in, we were crossing this really long bridge, and Abby and I were just kind of reflecting on the trip and on the day and how amazing our four students were, who were kind of battling through all these things and who were so committed to the work that we were doing there, and were such great colleagues and such great partners. And Abby said, "I wish every day could feel this way at school." And I thought it was really funny because, you know, we were filthy and exhausted and suffering from elevation issues, and the trip was, again, derailed 100 different times, and it was amazing. And so that was the moment we kind of reflected for a moment, and then we decided if we could build a school, we'd want it to feel kind of like that. Like, we wanted to feel the commitment and the rigor and the joy and the power. And so we came back. That was spring break of 2015. I left my current position about a week later, and that's when the work really began.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
And I will also say that when we say the work really began, we had no idea what the work was. it was very symbolic that the work began. And in fact, the day that we made it public that we were doing it, literally, I just put a Facebook post on my personal Facebook page that said, you know, "We are going to start a school. I hope that's exciting to you," or something, right? And unbeknownst to me, and certainly in an unpredictable way, that Facebook page, that Facebook post really caught fire in our community. And that was kind of our first inkling that maybe there's a need here. Maybe there's a gap here. Maybe our community would get excited about this. We kind of just went from there.
I love the idea of you on the bridge. I have those moments. I can remember those moments and how they felt. Why can't school always be like this? Yes,
that's why I always loop back to outdoor education. There are moments when there are this kind of flow moments when teaching feels very powerful and very connected, and it's kind of a function of your own training and your own and the trust you've built with your kids and also your curriculum and also the vision for where it's going. And there's powerful moments that I don't think any other industry can replicate the way that great teaching can. And that bridge was one of those moments where we were like, this is the way our lives should feel. And everything kind of came from that.
I have to say that I remember a misty morning at Chewonky in Maine, when we were doing up there with an outdoor ed program, and getting up and looking out at the water through the fog and thinking, this is just the way it really should be. And I can't say I went and started a school in response, but, but it had a profound influence on the way I think about school and teaching, I guess. Well, some sort of practical questions. Starting a school is hard. Did you always intend on having it be an independent school? Did you ever ponder going charter or even like for profit? Any of that kind of model in your mind ever?
No, for a couple reasons. For us, I think that first and foremost, there was a charter school in Lancaster. There was an attempt to open a charter in Lancaster. 6 or 7 years ago, and it was not only not successful, but it kind of rubbed our community the wrong way. Mm-hmm. There was some not great design behind it. There was some not great. Lancaster is a very close knit city in a lot of ways. And I think that charter has made it difficult for future charters to open in Lancaster. And there's certainly a number of really extraordinary charter schools and charter school models, and we would never compare ourselves in a positive or negative way to that model. But it seemed actually more difficult to us to do it that way. There was a time where we considered partnering with a local Quaker organization. Mm-hmm. And we had some really wonderful conversations with the Council of Friends Education. Mm-hmm. I can't quite remember their name.
Council on Education.
Correct. There it is. Thank you. We had some great conversations with them, and we felt a lot of connection to, their vision for schools that are socially just and really committed to democratic process. But at the end of the day, I'm an independent school guy, and I love independent school campuses, and I love independent school culture. To be honest with you, it came down to, can we figure out what it takes to actually open these things, mm-hmm. right? It came down to, are we able to do the really ground level kind of grinding that you do on all the action steps that it takes to get a school open? And that process was the one that really, really helped us choose our structure and define our model and define our program.
So I have to ask too, so what made this time and this place right for starting a school? Previously, you and I have talked about the Mastery Transcript Consortium, and you're part of mm-hmm. that. Were there things in the zeitgeist that drew you forward? This is also the time when I get to ask one of my standard questions about, what ideas, books, thought leaders, resources have been inspiring and guiding you and the other folks at the Stone Independent School, and listening to all that.
What's been the best part of this process has been getting outside of our own thoughts about what school can be, what school can feel like, and really engaging the national conversations about what the product of an independent school really should be. And I'll tell you that's a conversation we have all the time, is what is our product really supposed to be, right? Mm-hmm. Our trustees have all been involved in school governance, and in fact, a few of them have founded K-8 progressive schools. We have a lot of experience on our board in terms of talking about education. And so when we first constructed our board, and that whole process is I can drill down on a little bit as well. But when we first started build our board, we were all talking about the same thing, which was that the testing industry has had this negative impact on schools, and quite frankly, the testing industry has harmed our students. And I believe that, and we talk about that everywhere we go, that we are harming our students. But I will also say that as aware as we were of the impact of the testing industry, and as aware as we were that there was this conversation that was beginning to happen in a lot of different corners in education I also don't know that we knew what we were talking about. You know, and so over the last 3.5 years, those mentors have really helped us. And so the first one we always point to is Scott Looney out of Hawken. Scott heard about us very early on in the Master Transcript Consortium process, and invited us to take part in the MTC. And that experience of listening to somebody like Scott really talk, you know, who's standing on a platform of a very powerful, incredibly successful, you know, massive endowment, you know, huge endowment style school, talk about the things that we were feeling, I think really gave us evidence that even with no kids and at the time, you know, an administrative team of three and no faculty and no building. And also, by the way, we didn't even have a name for the school.
Story.
Our legal name was the TBA school, the to be announced school. And we chose it because I had to register the corporation so we could pay taxes. And it was kind of an in-joke. And then the more we said it, the more we thought, well, that's kind of a cool name for a school. And in fact, we all even had like, we kind of had this idea for a marketing campaign where people around our town would, you know, kind of hold up a sign that says like, I am to be announced or something like that. And I got really excited by it. And then we went to the first Mastery Transcript Consortium meeting out in Cleveland. And, you know, there's these huge schools there, schools that were really influential for us. You know, Putney was there, and obviously Hawken is there, and Boys Latin is there, and another 85 awesome schools. And I walk in and put on a name tag that says Mike Simpson, head of school, TBA. and somebody came up to me at the cocktail party that night and said, are you here to apply for a job? and you know, I just put my tail between my legs and slinked away. And I think the next day we said to our board, hey, we need a name. And that became its own complicated design process. But, you know, Scott Looney was a huge influence over our school. I had a really formative conversation 2 summers ago with Emily Jones up at Putney. Emily, you know, spent 2 or 3 hours with me and talked about, talked really in a really granular way about how Putney feels about assessment. Mm-hmm. And asked me some really difficult questions about assessment that, to be perfectly honest, at the time I couldn't answer. And put some ideas in my head about what a transcript could look like if we got away from our obsession with these arbitrary letters and started thinking about transcripts as expressions of learning, and started thinking about transcripts as ways for our students to kind of stand apart from each other and to design through lines and really individualize themselves. You know, we have a handful of schools that we look at all the time. We talk about Calhoun and Putney and Buxton and the Cambridge School of Weston. And we spend a lot of time looking at their schedule and looking at the design of their curriculum, looking at their credit systems. We also had some great conversations with younger schools. Greg Bamford out at Watershed out in Colorado. Mm-hmm. He also works with the leadership and design, you know, company. Mm-hmm. He was really helpful for us in terms of thinking about the design of our school and what we were capable of. We also talked a lot with Beacon Academy there in Evanston. Beacon, I think, opened about 3 years before we did. They came out of a large group of Montessori families interested in building a really creative high school. And so they were really helpful. We were able to talk through, you know, what is the first year really like? And what kind of kids do you attract the first year? And what are the mistakes that you made? And what do you read? And so being able to scale, look at schools at different scales, looking at mm-hmm. schools that were 2 or 3 years old and looking at schools that were 130 years old was helpful. And also reading a lot. You know, we point to, we've been talking a lot about Ted Dintersmith's new book. We talk to, right now we're asking our entire community to read Todd Rose's The End of Average. Mm-hmm. we have been able to reach out to the Global Online Academy and the Khan Lab School and kind of get some input from them about what a little more technologically savvy vision of a school could look like. It's been, you know, it's been nothing but learning and nothing but borrowing. And what has been the most powerful, without question, the most powerful part of this process has been the extraordinary generosity of all of these schools, who are willing to say, we see a difference. We see a way that schools can change. We see a way that education can grow. We have some ideas. We don't know if they work. Take what you need, and tell us what you're doing. And that's been really powerful.
That's fantastic. And I have to say, I'm pleased to hear so many ICG partner schools named in your list of schools.
Well, we'll get to that. I will tell you that what was very helpful for us, there's a difference between, you know, learning how to build your program and learning how to open a school, you know? And what was very helpful from the younger schools was learning that we needed four things, and that was kind of how we built our strategic plan. We knew that we needed the education, and that came from us, you know, going through the ICG partner page obsessively. We needed to raise a lot of money. We had none. We literally began, I think, the first 7 months of this, we didn't even have a bank account. We needed to get legal, and we needed students. And that, knowing those four things, the education, the money, the students, and getting legal, all came from this web of generous startup schools who could all say, here are the bumps you're going to run into, here's how you do it, or here's what we did, call us if you need us, you know?
Oh, that's great. Well, I'd like to ask you some nuts and bolts question, maybe questions about some of those. Yeah. Can you touch briefly on some of the regulatory stuff that you and businessy stuff that you had to deal with? And I that may lead to accreditation. I don't know how that works even for a brand new school.
Yeah, I can touch briefly, or I can talk for 4 hours about this.
Briefly probably be good here, because you have a school to run.
Sure. It's probably fine. It's downstairs. You know, in Pennsylvania, broadly speaking, there are five kinds of schools. There are public schools, there are charter schools, there are religious schools, there are private licensed and private accredited. Okay. Obviously, we're not a public school. We chose not to be a charter school. We considered going down the path of being some form of parochial school. That would have been the Quaker option. Mm-hmm. And in Pennsylvania, to be perfectly honest, there's almost no regulation of religious schools. You effectively create bylaws and you fill out literally a three-page piece of paper, and you're done. That left us with accreditation or licensing. Mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, there are three legal accreditation companies, three recognized, PAIS, Middle States, and Advanced Ed. Mm-hmm. And none of those organizations will work with you until you're either 2 or 3 years old. So our only real option was to get licensed by the state. It turns out getting licensed by the state is incredibly difficult. And in fact, on the days where we thought about giving up, and over the course of 2 years of planning and designing, there were many. I mean, this is a very difficult, it's a very difficult and all-consuming job, opening up a school. You know, a job that impacts, you know, your relationships, your friendships, your family. It really becomes all-consuming, and kind of everybody in your network has to know that you're heading into this, right? Mm-hmm. But over the course of all the challenges, the only times we thought about giving up were when the license became so cumbersome or difficult or, quite frankly, perplexing, mm-hmm. that we just couldn't take it any longer. Best case scenario, getting the school license takes about 180 days.
Wow.
In our case, it took about 270. There was a 300 or 400 page document that we prepared. There's 20 steps to the license, and it takes you through everything from Pennsylvania state school code to very arbitrary rules that the state has about your school specifically. For example, they are very, very interested in how many urinals you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that correlates directly to the number of boys that you have in your school, which we found to be both arbitrary and also very difficult for us to wrap our heads around, given the kind of community that we want to create here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, asking 100% of our students to identify as either yeah. male or female felt wrong to us. But we had to identify only by those two options to the state in order to determine how many urinals we needed. So the license takes you from everything from school code to what size your classrooms can be to making sure that you have some kind of financial planning to designing, you know, 9 through 12, what your curriculum is and aligning it sort of towards state standards. It was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And what was most difficult about it was that there was a lot of elements that the state wanted that was not on the license or, in fact, anywhere. And so an example would be we completed our license and we had a site inspection. And this was in, I want to say, February of last year. And this, we thought this was the final step in our licensing process, and in a process that really was difficult. And we had our site inspection, and our inspector came out, and she asked us where all the books were. And we said, well, we don't have the books. Our families will order the books this summer, you know. And she said, no, I need to see every copy of every book you're going to teach in every classroom it'll be taught in today.
Good grief.
Yeah. And so we failed that inspection. And it was, that was a day where I will tell you that if you wanted to look at one of the days
that day, I can imagine.
It doesn't say that online. There's no list. There's no, there's nothing other than this person says you need every book. The regulatory side of it is very front-loaded. You have to go through this process, and it's very unclear. There's a database in Pennsylvania that tracks every school that opens that has opened in the last, I don't know, 20 years. And when we went through it, we could only find one other licensed 9 through 12 non-special ed school that had opened in the last 5 years because the process is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have a lot of peers. You don't have anybody that you can turn to. You have a system that doesn't explain itself or reveal itself to you in any way. And all you can do is kind of just keep fighting. And the last part of that, which is difficult and maybe not particularly interesting to your audience, but is part of our story, is that the board that approves your license only meets every 90 days. Okay. So that meant when we failed it in April, March, the next board meeting, this is incredible. The next board meeting was August 16th. And we were set to open on August 20th. And so we share with people in a way that makes sense. The depth of anxiety and fear that after 2 years of working on a thing, it would all come down to a board hearing 4 days before you opened. And obviously we got our license. And in fact, when we got our license, the board said to us, they said two things. They said, first and foremost, they asked if they could apply and come to the school. And second, they said that ours is exactly the model of school they wanted to see open in Pennsylvania. So it was great, but I got to tell you, it was hard.
Wow. I had not expected that much. I mean, I figured it would be hard, but I was not expecting that kind of complexity in a system almost designed to make sure that schools like that don't open in Pennsylvania.
Well, that's what's really interesting is that if you're thinking about opening a school, the state you do it in, and I know this is obvious, but the state you do it in will really impact the design. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a school that's opening out in Montana called the Bozeman Field School. I'm not sure if they're open this year or next year, but they're a place-based education design. The school looks beautiful. Everything about it was really thrilling to us as we look at their website. And yet we couldn't do it here. We couldn't do that kind of thing in Pennsylvania. And if you look at states where a lot of independent schools, where a lot of innovation is happening in independent schools, there are often states that regulate to incentivize schools to open. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, we've had a lot of great relationships in the Department of Education here in Pennsylvania, but I don't know that we ever felt incentivized to open, mm-hmm. And so that was a real challenge for us.
Well, congratulations for making it through there.
That was a long story, and I know that. But it's I often think that if people are, those people who consider opening a school, first of all, I would encourage everybody to do it. But second of all, it's important not to have misconceptions because it's a wonderful challenge.
Well, Mike, how do you present the idea of a brand new school that's operating on principles that are also very new and probably unfamiliar to many potential families and students? How do you get that word out there? And are brand and identity things that evolve as the school becomes real? But they're also based on these core beliefs that are in your gut. But how do you communicate to people what you're going to be doing and what the value proposition is and how's that going?
Yeah, it's absolutely an evolution. It is absolutely the case that the volume of learning that you'll do over the course of starting a school will be unmatched, will quickly outpace the volume of learning you've consumed or done over the course of the rest of your career. You just learn so much so quickly that you realize, every month you look backwards a month and say, my gosh, we didn't know anything back then. There's a picture of us on opening day, the first day of school, and I look at that picture and I just think, that guy was so young. The first thing that you have to figure out or the first thing that you will get challenged over is the why of your school. It's the why, right? Mm-hmm. And when we started, we did not have the answer. We had, a very, very idealistic and very optimistic vision of what I would refer to as kind of look, feel. Someone would say, what's different about your school? And by the way, every person who hears about your school when it starts up will say, what's different? Right? Mm-hmm. And our answer wasn't great back then. It was very much like, we want to build this collaborative, really joyful place where people love to come in the building, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we did want to do those things. And that really remains true. Those are our values. But we had to have a why that made sense in our market. And so when we looked at our market, Lancaster is an amazing place in that it has, 5 or 6 just wonderful public schools. I mean, like really, really wonderful public schools. It has an independent school that's very successful and is 110 years and is constantly building more large and beautiful buildings. It has 2 or 3 very good parochial schools. And it has a number of progressive K-8 communities that are all doing interesting things. What it didn't have was a school that said, we don't believe in testing. It just didn't exist. And in fact, what was fortunate for us is that the schools around us, by and large, and I mean this very respectfully, are all kind of pursuing the same model, the kind of traditional AP shape of a mm-hmm. high school. And so for us, it started with our why. We believe that the testing industry is suffocating the creativity, the natural creativity in American high schools. That's our why, right? And once we began to talk about it, our brand kind of emerged. And I'll tell you, there isn't anybody on the planet who will argue with you that there should be more standardized testing, right? That person doesn't exist. And if that person does exist, you don't want them in your community anyway. But I have pitched our school, 75 times in the last 3 years, and I've never had anybody raise their hand and say, but I want more standardized testing, right? Mm-hmm. And so that value prop, that why led us to our value proposition, which is doing the research and saying, is it conceivable that schools have better outcomes when they don't rely on the arbitrary notion of testing as a value, right? And that argument's not that hard to win. There aren't a lot of things that correlate to being good at testing, and testing hasn't ever showed us that it's that skill is difficult to acquire, you know. Mm-hmm. And so on either end of the testing argument, it gave us room to say, if we get rid of this thing, if we stop doing this thing, what are the outcomes that we can create? And that led us to go around our community and hold, 15 or 20 big room info sessions, and also sit in 150 offices and living rooms and anywhere that anybody would listen to us, and talk about what project-based learning really looks like, talk about true 21st century skills, talk about things like most likely to succeed. I mean, I probably showed most likely to succeed 15 times. As a way of saying, wouldn't it be amazing if we could teach kids to make things, if we could teach kids to synthesize, and if we could teach kids to fail really well, you know? And through that, our brand and our vision for our school and our marketing tools all kind of emerged. And it's been great. We have a lot of great support in our community right now. We have a donor base that's very excited to help us out when we need it. We are doubling in size next year. We think we'll be at 125 in about 3 years. And so far, what we're preaching is being heard.
Wow. Congratulations and well done, you, all of you.
Also say that every night I go to bed, I feel sick to my stomach and terrified.
Well, I think I can understand that. You sort of touched on this earlier, but, you know, if you had one word of advice, or maybe one sentence of advice to give to listeners who may have this school founding itch, and I, you know, as I think you and I talked about, my grandfather had this itch back in 1926, and he did it. What would you say to people who are thinking about this?
It's two pieces of advice. The first is that everywhere you go, you will be challenged on your credentials. Okay. Mm-hmm. Our industry is a very credential-driven. And, you know, we love badging each other, and we love badging schools, and we love, you know, kind of the traditional method of moving through the independent school universe. I remember sitting down with my head of school 12 or 13 years ago and having him outline the jobs that I would need to get in order to one day be head of an upper school. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what I think we found is that if you are committed to learning this job, if you're committed to learning all the parts of it, not just designing the curriculum, because that's the fun part, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're committed to learning about accounting and understanding how the taxation, the tax side works, and learning how to manage a board of trustees, and learning about marketing, and learning about, you know, Google AdWords and things like that. If you're committed to it, you can do it. You can absolutely do it. But you have to be comfortable with the idea that, especially in the beginning, especially until you have a brand, everywhere you go, someone will say, I love your idea. Who's going to be the head of school? Right. And the second piece of advice is what I already said, which is you have to know why. It hasn't stopped for me yet. Everybody wants to know, how are we different? And if you can't say it, it gets harder and harder to convince people that you are different, you know? So don't worry about your credentials, but be committed to learning and know why you're doing it.
Well, that's interesting to me, because the Independent Curriculum Group, we have our own evolving brand, I guess, as we sort of try to make our case. We started out as one thing, and are trying to tell the world and help ourselves understand how much more broadly we need to understand that. So, and as I learn more about the Stone Independent School, it seems like you guys are really kind of the poster child right now in our community for the idea of independent curriculum, that it really is, you know, we have a little sort of, you know, innovative by definition tagline, that if you're doing this for the first time in a school, focusing on your own students, it is innovative by definition. It's something brand new in the world.
Yeah.
And you have to be doing it in your own original way. And so I have to ask, because I always do, what can organizations like the Independent Curriculum Group do to continue supporting the kinds of work that you and other people who are as visionary and as ambitious in all the good ways as you are? What can we do to support you? What do you need from us?
From a broad perspective, the ICG, I can't begin to underestimate how important the ICG was for us in a very passive way, which was that I think for our first year, I'll bet I was on the partner website twice a day, every single day for a year. It gave us a way to look at schools that we assumed shared something similar. And it gave us a way to really build a network of ideas. And I can't begin to tell you how powerful that was for us. In fact, to this day in our pitch, we have a section about joining the ICG and getting access to hundreds of schools all across the country who are committed to a list of things that we like to talk about. So that's really powerful. You know, what we get excited by now probably isn't as exciting to, a broad swath of schools, but I would love to see more conversation in the independent school world and maybe through the ICG about a couple things. The first is I do think having conversations with young schools is really important. There are people out there who are trying to start schools. I've talked to a couple in the last week or two. And there's no clearinghouse of resources. You know, there's a school in Pittsburgh that we talk to a lot, City of Bridges School. Mm-hmm. They're opening in 2019. And there's a school that I just talked to out in Los Angeles called the Ocean School. And I'm sure there's hundreds of other schools like us that had a website, but no kids and no building and need help. You put out your shingle and you just hope. But I also think that there are what we have at our advantage is that we are at that stage of our lives as a school where we can be very dynamic and we can beta almost anything, you know, having conversations at our administrative team level about opening up a lab school next year. And we're very excited by it. Yeah, I know, right? And we're incredibly excited by the model that we're putting together. But it's hard to find comparable models. It's hard to find people that we can really talk to about these things. And so I often wish that I don't know what form this looks like, but I often wish that there was a way for all of us to find a common space where we can talk about our most innovative or complex programmatic ideas, you know. And who's beta, where the betas are and what the successes are and what the failures are. For us, we need peers. And that's what gets us really excited is who are our peers and who can help us design a lab school, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm not sure if that's the ICG's role or not, but I'll tell you that that's what we look for. A clearinghouse or a space where we can really share some complex and sometimes ill-formed thoughts.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you, Mike, so much for your time today. This conversation could go on and on and on, and I hope that it does in all kinds of ways. But thank you for your time, and more importantly, for the work you're doing at the Stone Independent School to support, promote, and enact the principles of independent curriculum as we see them, but also, and much more so, I don't want to use you. We're not basking in your reflected glory. We really are excited by, I'm personally very excited by the great new resource that you guys are offering to families and kids down in Lancaster. So,
yeah, I mean, I think we're, ultimately we're so grateful to you and to the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of amazing schools that came before us that gave us the resources to kind of figure this thing out. And so I think every day we get up and we just feel really lucky to be part of this broader conversation in this broader community, and really grateful specifically to you for all you do, for all these kind of United Progressive Schools.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you very much. I'm jealous of you guys, what you're doing. It would be so fun to be a part of that. So, listeners, we're going to be posting Mike's contact information along with a pressy of this podcast so that those of you who have been engaged and inspired by this conversation can follow up and, besiege Mike and the other folks at Stone with your own questions and ideas, and please offer resources also to me, if you would please. You can check out the Stone Independent Schools website at stoneindependent.org. And again, thank you, Mike. This has just been a great conversation.
Thank you.
This is Peter Gao for the Independent Curriculum Group, thanking our listeners for being with us for this episode of Independent Curriculum, the podcast, and reminding listeners that you can learn more about us and find our podcast archive at independentcurriculum.org.